For centuries, people had little idea what went on in their leaders' private conversations. But with the rise of recording equipment, we've gotten a few more insights. Richard Nixon's Watergate tapes, for example, revealed a side of him that hadn't been widely seen. He liked to swear.
All right, you get a hold of Weinberger and say, I want the funds and I want him to know it now. Get it done, right?
Okay. These days, the use of profanity may be more than just a slip of the tongue. Here's Yahoo CEO Carol Bartz responding to a question from an interviewer who insinuated her company wasn't moving fast enough on new technology.
You're just getting
I don't want to hear any crap about something magical that the fine people of Yahoo are supposed to do in this short time. So f*** off.
And last month, President Obama used some strong language about the people cleaning up the BP oil spill.
We talked to these folks because they potentially had the best answers, so I know who's a to kick.
As it turns out, our leaders sometimes swear strategically. And here to talk about when it works and when it doesn't is Robert Sutton. He's an organizational psychologist who teaches at Stanford University. Robert Sutton, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here, Lynn.
And I should mention that you're also the author of a book, Unfortunately, We Can't. Mention the title of that book on the air.
It's the no jerk rule, but it really isn't jerk. It's a letter that starts with an A and rhymes with castle.
Let me ask you how you know when a leader is intentionally deciding to swear or use profanity and when it's a slip.
Well, I think that the main sign we can tell is when it's a backstage versus a front stage. Especially when some of the backstage kind of leaks out. There was one point when President Bush sort of whispered to Cheney that there was a reporter in the audience who was a jerk.
Adam Clymer, major league
Oh, yeah, sick time.
But the example I think you had of Carol Bartz and also President Obama, I think they were using it quite strategically. And I even suspect in the case of Obama, it was in a script or something they had discussed, because swear words, taboo words, pack an emotional wallop that the ordinary words, the replacements, simply cannot.
Well, what might a person be trying to accomplish by using a word like that that packs a wallop?
Well, sometimes it's kind of a bonding effect. I mean, if you listen to the backstage tapes with both Lyndon Johnson and with President Nixon, that was just the way those guys talked to one another. So it's just part of being the group. Another effect is that when you want to shock people and especially create emotional arousal, Carol Bartz, I think that's a lot of what she's doing strategically. And then the last thing is authenticity. That's who Carol is, and it comes across very straightforward. And in fact, she's got a very tough turnaround job at Yahoo. And to me, that shows that she's a tough boss and she means it.
And let's talk about the fact that Carol Bartz is a woman. And would a woman particularly decide to use that kind of language as a way to prove herself to the guys?
In the case of somebody like Carol Bartz, I hate to bring up the notion of personality, but I believe Carol has always been that way. Let's just say that Michelle Obama started talking like that. I think we would all just be horrified and shocked. But Carol Bartz, it's sort of like a comedian talking that way.
I guess the quote that kind of sums it up, I think it comes from General Patton, "When I want it to stick, I give it to them loud and dirty."
And I think that's very consistent with the notion that words are just tools in a toolbox. And sometimes when you really need that wallop, you want to get out the word. But then there's other times when you don't want to give it to them loud and dirty because you embarrass them. You get them all cranked up and you've kind of got a mess on your hands. So this stuff is very related to the context and what you're trying to accomplish. And that can be for good or can be for evil.
Robert Sutton is a professor in Stanford's Management, Science, and Engineering Department. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Writer Tana French lived all over the world as she was growing up, but her books are grounded in Dublin, the city she now calls home. Her latest novel, Faithful Place, takes readers into a grim corner of Dublin where families do their best to suffocate dreams and cops are to be avoided at all costs. Detective Frank Mackey escaped from there long ago, but the discovery of a body in an abandoned house brings him back to the place and the family he hoped he'd left behind forever. Tana French joins us now to discuss her new book. Welcome to the program, Tana.
Thanks very much. Hi.
Well, Frank Mackey tries to get away from this neighborhood, Faithful Place, when he's 19 years old. And I'd love if you could read a description of the night that he thought that he was getting away.
Yeah, sure. That'd be great. I was 19, old enough to take on the world and young enough to be a dozen kinds of stupid. And that night, as soon as both my brothers were snoring, I slid out of our bedroom with my rucksack on my back and my Docs hanging from one hand. A floorboard creaked, and in the girls' room, one of my sisters murmured in her sleep. But I was magic that night, riding high on that surge tide, unstoppable. My parents didn't even turn over on the pull-out bed as I moved through the front room, close enough to touch. The fire had burned down to nothing but a muttering red glow. In the rucksack was everything important I owned. Jeans, t-shirts, a second-hand wireless, 100 quid and my birth cert. That was all you needed to go over to England back then. Rosie had the ferry tickets.
So he gets stood up by his girlfriend, and it's 20 years later that he realizes that his girlfriend Rosie was killed on that night. It's the discovery of her body that pulls him back into the old neighborhood, back into the arms of his family. And that's really where the novel proceeds from. Mm-hmm. But a lot of this story, it seems to me, is really about the idea that you can't escape your past and you can't escape your blood.
Yeah, I think very much so. It's a book about family and about home. And Frank blamed his family for the fact that Rosie had, as he thought, stood him up. He thought the fact that his family was so terminally dysfunctional was what had driven her away. And so he ran. But the fact is that his new family, his wife and his daughter, he hasn't made a great job of that. But this may be because, in fact, he tried to erase his whole sense of family.
What is it about this idea of people wanting to erase their past or erase their connections with their family that you find so interesting that you've explored it in a couple of books now?
I think it could be because I do live in Ireland. I am living in Ireland. And here over the past 15, 20 years, the relationship between past, present and future has been a very complex and very fraught one in that we had this huge economic boom. And during the economic boom, there was a sense that Ireland was escaping from a past of hideous poverty. And there was a feeling that the only way we could grab hold of this wonderful, rich, consumer heaven present that we were being offered was this idea that we cannot in any way pay any respect to our past if we want to hold on to the future, that the two are somehow mutually exclusive. Because that's been such a crucial tension within Ireland over the last 15, 20 years. I think that's why it keeps resurfacing in the books.
Well, neighborhood plays an incredibly important role in this novel. Tell me a little bit more about this area of Dublin that you're writing about in Faithful Place. It's called the Liberties.
Yes, the Liberties. See, for centuries and centuries, the Liberties had a separate charter from the rest of Dublin. The rules there were different. They made their own way. That's hence the name, the Liberties. That gave the area a very distinctive and very special character where people have known each other for generations, know everything about each other's family. You can have an argument that's based on what somebody's great-grandfather did in the year 1900. The families that are interwoven by so much intermarriage and so much knowledge leads to a whole different level of intensity of community from what you'd get in almost any other area, I think.
There's a really wonderful description of the neighborhood in the book that I'd like you to read. It begins with, "The place was winding down for the night," if you could read there.
The place was winding down for the night. A telly threw stuttering flickers on the Dwyer's wall. Music was seeping faintly from somewhere, a woman's sweet, wistful voice aching out over the gardens. In number 7, multicoloured Christmas lights and pudgy Santa sparkled in the windows, and one of Sally Hearn's current crop of teenagers screamed, "No, I hate you!" and slammed a door. On the top floor of number 5, the epidural yuppies were putting their kid to bed, Daddy carrying him into his room, fresh from the bath in a little white dressing gown, swinging him into the air and blowing raspberries on his tummy, Mummy laughing and bending to shake out blankets. Just across the road, my ma and my dad were presumably staring catatonically at the telly, wrapped in their separate, unimaginable thoughts, seeing if they could make it to bedtime without having to talk to each other.
Dublin is almost a character in Faithful Place. And you, as I said, have lived all over the world. You could have been an international crime writer, but you've really chosen to focus on Dublin. Why?
I think partly because this is the one place that I think I have any right to call home. It's the only place where I know the little things like what's the shortcut from A to B and what bus route do you take and where has a good pint or a good pizza, and little things like that give you the capacity to make that place come alive for readers. And in a weird way, I think that being almost but not quite from here actually gives me in some ways an advantage, because there are things that you would take for granted about a place if you were born and bred there. Whereas if you're part outsider still, then you notice these cultural assumptions, these undercurrents, these things that to a real insider are so much a part of the fabric of life. And I think as a part outsider, it's easier to pick up on them and integrate them into what you're writing.
Tana French, her new book is Faithful Place. Tana, so good talking with you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
To Kill a Mockingbird is 50 years old this weekend. Harper Lee's novel still sells nearly a million copies every year and has possibly become what amounts to the great American novel of the 20th century, telling a story of the South before the modern civil rights movement, through the eyes of a small girl, an innocent man who's wrongly charged, a mysterious stranger next door, and a simple country lawyer and father who embodies true American nobility. The book has informed and inspired more than two generations of Americans, including writers, artists, and activists. Among them, James McBride. Mr. McBride's the author of the best-selling memoir, The Color of Water, and novels including Song Yet Sung, as well as a composer and jazz musician. He joins us from member station WHYY in Philadelphia. Thank you for being with us.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
Do you remember that first copy of Mockingbird that you read?
Oh, yeah. You know, I grew up in a house of 12 kids, you know, and so we had books all over the place. And that first copy was a dog-eared book. When I say dog-eared, I mean a dog probably had a go at it, you know. And I started reading the first page and couldn't stop. I hid the book so that my brothers and sisters couldn't find it.
Oh, that's a tribute.
Until I finished it.
So do you remember reading it? I mean, where you sat, how long it took?
Well, first of all, that book came when I was living in Jamaica, Queens, New York, in a working class black community. And so Macomb County that Miss Lee put together was like the moon to me. Mm-hmm. Yet I just completely related to all the characters. I wasn't really sophisticated enough, first of all, to understand how racism worked. And so at the age of, 10, 12 years old, to see how this young girl negotiated a lot of these difficult elements was just, for me, fascinating. Mm-hmm. And also, because my family had originally come from the South, I learned a lot about the South that I didn't know. This was a part of America that was completely different than New York, yet I related to just about everyone in the book.
And now as an adult novelist and memoirist, what do you admire about the book?
Well, first of all, technically, it's a wonderful book. I mean, it's a brilliant work because it begins with it's basically the story of how this young girl's brother broke his arm over the course of, a summer. And so that sets up, she begins the book with that. And then she just spins into backstory to tell the reader how this happens. Spiritually, it's a masterpiece because it deals with the innocence of a young child and how that innocence is sullied by the real world as this six-year-old girl starts to realize that these enormous concrete gates of reality are starting to, construct themselves around her in terms of how people live racially and class-wise and so forth. Her innocence is gradually being chipped away, and she's trying to hang on to that. And that's really the true power of the book.
How does she write about African-American characters in your judgment?
Well, I mean, one of the professional criticisms of To Kill a Mockingbird is that her African-American characters are like one-dimensional. They're not that deep. Calpurnia, for example, the housekeepers, she falls into the hands on their hips. You missed a gem, don't you? She wrote the book in the 50s. This was the world that she knew. In terms of, technically, what six-year-old white girl from Alabama is going to be that curious about the black people around her? She even says in the book, the character Scout wants to visit Calpurnia's house, but she's not allowed to. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, her black characters are a little bit, they're not as fully dimensional as you'd find in a Toni Morrison novel. But they still tell a great story. They're morally deep. They're morally sound. In fact, they're a lot better than a lot of black characters written by a lot of black writers now. In this hip-hop age, you know, I don't mind sharing this book with my daughter. There are a lot. I'd rather that she see some of these characters than some of the heroes that are walking around now.
You mentioned your daughter. As a father, is it hard to measure up to Atticus Finch?
Well, yeah. I mean, Atticus Finch is, you know, he was just his whole, the business of his modesty and his ability to see tomorrow and to try to buttress his knowledge of what was coming for his kids was something that I'll never, as a father, I'm not able to do. And also, he was abused because he took on this case in a small town.
Yeah.
And he had the courage not to fight back. He was really a kind of almost like a Martin Luther King character in that he was a man who believed in nonviolence and practiced it.
You have written a big bestseller and keep writing. As an artist, what do you make of the fact that this is the only published novel that Harper Lee has ever written?
You know, John Coltrane, when he was playing in Europe, Rashid Ali, who was the drummer in Coltrane's band, tells a wonderful story about at a certain point where they were playing, Coltrane was playing, he just took the horn out of his mouth and just started beating his chest and singing. And so after the gig, Rashid went to John Coltrane and said, you know, John, what's the matter? I mean, what's going on? And Coltrane said, there's just nothing left on the horn to play. And I feel that way about To Kill a Mockingbird and Harper Lee. She sang the great song. She did the great work. If she never writes another word, she's done enough. She's bared her soul for all of us. And so there's nothing else to say.
Mr. McBride, I can't thank you enough. Thanks so much for talking to us about To Kill a Mockingbird.
Thank you.
James McBride, distinguished writer in residence at NYU, and he's among the notables in a new collection of interviews that celebrate the 50th anniversary of To Kill a Mockingbird, Scout, Atticus, and Boo.
We're back with All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary. Joining us now, as he does most Saturdays, is our news analyst, James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic. Welcome, Jim. So good to have you and good to talk to you again.
Nice to talk with you, Lynn, and welcome back to your show.
Thanks. It's been a long time since I've done it. Now, I know that you have a special love for all things Google and China, and there was news on both fronts this week with China renewing Google's license to operate in that country. So how big a deal is this?
I think it's potentially significant, and at least at face value, it's fairly positive. The showdown between Google and the Chinese government has been building over the past 6 months, ever since Google announced it would no longer comply with Chinese requests that Google itself censor web results for users in China. And the climax came this month because the Chinese government had to decide whether or not to renew Google's permit to operate in China at all. And Google has found ways to maintain its principles while complying with the letter, though not the spirit of Chinese law by redirecting people to a site in Hong Kong. And the news was the Chinese government said, okay, we think this is sufficient and you can go ahead. It's good, I think, for users in China. They can still take advantage of the service. And it suggests that the Chinese government was not ready to go sort of to the next step of all-out showdown with Western information sources and Western values and all the rest.
And what does this mean in terms of Chinese censorship of search results?
In practical terms, it really doesn't make any difference for any user inside China. The minority of people inside China, including foreigners who really want to or have to get to the outside unfiltered web, can do so through a variety of means. Most other users in China who don't want to go to that bother still will have censored search results. The difference, as a matter of principle, is that now the Chinese government is doing it with its so-called Great Firewall, as Google's results come in from its servers in Hong Kong, rather than Google itself doing the censoring as it had been doing before at Chinese request from its servers inside China.
So, Jim, I think I should mention that usually when we do these chats, you're in Washington, but this week you're in Aspen, Colorado, where you're attending the Aspen Ideas Festival, which is co-sponsored by The Atlantic. The point of the festival is well, at least part of it, is to explore issues in the news. And, of course, the BP oil spill is still very much in the news. So has there been any discussion about that?
There's been a tremendous amount of discussion. There have been ecological discussions and what this means in the long term for managing the oceans and so on. what to me has been the most newsworthy presentation is one that obviously had a self-interest, because it was several executives from Shell Oil making the presentation, and Shell is an underwriter of this conference. But it was quite compelling at face value, because they went through chapter and verse the way that Shell drills and designs its deep water oil wells, and what happened in the BP well that has caused this catastrophic loss. And when showing their own wells, they said, okay, here is level one of the redundant safety feature, and here's level two, and here's level eight, and here's level 12. And then they showed the comparative well that has had this disaster with many, many fewer of the safety features. And the contrast in these two well designs was quite striking, and I'm surprised as a consumer of news I haven't seen more places, and I hope actually I will soon.
And also, I hear that on another story, an official from the United Arab Emirates attending the festival made some surprising remarks about Iran. What was that all about?
Yes, the UAE's ambassador to the U.S., Ambassador Al-Otaiba, was being interviewed by Jeff Goldberg of The Atlantic, who asked him a direct question to which you very rarely get a direct answer in diplomacy. The direct question was, how would your country feel if either Israel or the United States took direct military action against Iran to prevent it from building nuclear weapons? And the ambassador said, well, that would be a catastrophe, but the only worse catastrophe would be essentially it not happening and Iran developing nuclear capabilities. And there was a tremendous amount of flap after that. The government back home in the United Arab Emirates said, well, we didn't mean it quite that way, out of context. There was Iran was having a diplomatic remonstrations against the UAE. It was dramatic both in showing the complexity of the decision that the U.S. faces on the Iranian situation, and also how rare it is to hear diplomats speaking undiplomatically.
Jim Fallows is national correspondent for The Atlantic and our regular news analyst. Jim, thanks so much. Great talking with you.
My pleasure. Thanks very much, Lynn.